This is Mike Dot with the Relax Back UK show on UK Health Radio, your global real feel-good radio station. On the Relax Back UK show, we explore all kinds of health topics, so keep listening and enjoy the ride. Hi, and thank you for joining me, Mike Dilk, on the Relax Back UK show this week. First topic is medicine derived from the cannabis plant. Sophie Hayes is a registered nurse and the clinical trial manager at LVL Clinic. They're helping patients with a wide variety of problems.
MS, EDS, like Ehlers-Danlos syndrome, fibromyalgia, rheumatoid arthritis, back pains, a huge range of conditions that we do help manage.
And they're also conducting a large trial into the use of these drugs, and Sophie explains that. Then, does anyone know how most of the fruit and veg available in supermarkets is grown?
Nearly 80% of the produce in supermarkets is hydroponically grown.
Kelly Seaman from Aqualabs tell us all about hydroponics. So please do stay with us for a great show. Thank you.
The station that makes you feel good.
Nagging pain. We at Alka-Seltzer know that a small amount of the patient's own bone marrow and blood cells can treat many painful conditions with regenerative orthopedic therapy. This is an attractive treatment option for painful joints, back pain, sports injuries, and many other conditions. It may avoid the need for surgery altogether. Alka-Seltzer. Part of a network of 50 RegenX clinics worldwide, where over 60,000 patients have been treated and helped. Alka-Seltzer. Life is more beautiful with less pain.
A cancer diagnosis can be scary and stressful for everyone involved. Hello Love is a contemporary living space and well-being center in central London where anyone can come and learn about illness prevention and non-toxic practice. Inside, you will find a vegan restaurant, juice bar, and holistic dojo that encourage lifestyle changes to help heal mind, body, and spirit connection. Cancer patients are offered free sessions. To find out more, please visit us at hellolove.org.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
So my first question for Sophie Hayes, who's the clinical trial manager at LVL, which is a clinic specialising in medicines derived from cannabis, was what kind of people can you help?
So we are a pain clinic, so a chronic pain clinic that's using cannabis-based medicines to sort of manage the multitude of symptoms that go along with chronic pain. So we take patients anywhere between the age of 18 and 85 who have chronic pain conditions that are currently unmanaged, but unfortunately at this point not cancer pain, cancer related pain. So it's chronic pain relating to MS, EDS, like Ehlers-Danlos syndrome, fibromyalgia, rheumatoid arthritis, back pains, a huge range of conditions that we do help manage.
Okay, but not cancer. That's interesting. Is there a particular reason for that? It just that cancer-based medicines don't work so well, or what?
No, so it's purely because of the research that we're conducting at the moment is focused on non-cancer chronic pain, because for pain related to cancer, there's a even more complex multitude of variables that go along with that contribute to that pain and that need to be managed, including the underlying condition. So
right.
That's why for research purposes, we're focusing on this a separated group.
Okay, I definitely want to get up later on in our chat into the research and the trials that you're doing. But let's start off, if I may, with just kind of concentrating on the clinical aspects. So you treat people with cannabis-based sort of medicines. And generally, people you treat, are they sort of people at the end of their tether and like come to you and say, look, I've tried everything. This is kind of my last act of desperation almost.
Yeah, I mean, both patients and their doctors, I think. So we get referral letters from doctors saying, you know, this my patient has asked me to sort of refer them into your clinic because we have between us tried both non-invasive and invasive methods. They tried multiple medications. They've tried tends machines, physiotherapy, like osteopath, acupuncture, yoga. So people, we tend to see people who are very engaged in trying to manage their symptoms in as many different ways as they can. And still, you know, they're part of that statistic of 8 million people from the British Pain Society that currently live with unmanaged pain in the UK.
Right.
Yes, we see people who really are, they've exhausted all other avenues.
So, but generally your patients are very motivated to get better.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And I mean, if you were living with chronic pain, it's something that you're constantly looking for research, projects, programs. You're always looking for something that could potentially alleviate what you're experiencing.
Sure.
We're just offering something new.
Yeah, I guess I've been lucky in my life so far. You know, like I've had the odd aching pain here or there, but I don't think I've ever had chronic pain. So, yeah, I can only be thankful for that. Right. So with pain medications, quite often when you read the packet, it says, you know, don't operate heavy machinery, don't drive a car, this sort of thing. So with cannabis based medicines, are there similar sorts of rules, guidelines? How does it work?
So at the moment, we advise patients to, because we're administering an inhaled sort of short-acting medication in the form of a cannabis flower, that you don't operate heavy machinery, get in your car and drive, cook for about 2 hours after administering the medication, just as a safety precaution, essentially. But otherwise, in terms of driving, it's treated as a controlled drug in the same way opioids are.
Right. Okay. So, but it's not, if you take opioids, but for pain, it says on the packet, you know, we suggest you don't drive, but everybody does, don't they? They've got a headache, they take one of these things and drive to work.
Well, I mean, it's one of those things where as the healthcare professional, it's not something you recommend. We're all aware that patients will do what they need to do to get on with their lives. So it's what we recommend that they do, obviously.
I suppose what I'm getting at and what I want to get across is cannabis-based medicines don't make you high. They don't space you out so you can get on with your life. That's I suppose, what I'm rather clumsily trying to say or ask.
Yeah, no, it's got a they've got a much better safety profile than opioids. And I think a lot of pain specialists in the UK are at that point where NICE, who sort of regulate the sort of who give out the guidelines on how to treat your group of patients for every speciality, NICE is slowly whittled away the resources that pain specialists have available to them. So they're now recommending that opioids are not appropriate for long-term pain management, which I think a lot of pain specialists and chronic pain patients were well aware of, but it's actually been formalized. So now this whole field is looking for this other group of medications that could provide relief from the symptoms without all the negative side effects of sort of addiction. A lot of pain patients talk about, not, you know, it dampens the pain, but it doesn't enable me to engage with, you know, my work life, my family life. And the word zombie is used very often. It's a very disassociative medication, whereas cannabis medicines, if it's the right dose for the right patient, and it's that for at LVL, we're researching the THC and CBD balanced flower product, then it shouldn't impair you in the way that opioids do.
Right. Okay. That's very good. One thing I have seen kind of on the news in general terms and looking on social media is that actually ensuring the quality of medicines derived from cannabis can be quite difficult because there are a lot of variables because you get different sorts of cannabis plants from different places. So is that an issue, and how do you guys deal with that?
So for anyone who is wanting to produce cannabis medicines and import them into the UK, they have to meet EU GMP guidelines. So those are the standards are required to be considered a safe medicine. EU GMP.
What does that stand for?
And the MHRI. Oh, EU GMP will be EU, European Union, General, that I don't know, actually, I should know. That's a very good question. But it's the standards that are required.
We ask the difficult questions on UK Health Radio.
I know you asked me the wrong question. but you also need to have a license from the MHRA, who are the Medicine Health Regulation Authority. That one I did know.
Right.
To administer it safely to patients in the UK. So, but you're right, there's a huge amount of variables that need to be controlled when producing cannabis medicines. And obviously the basis of all cannabis medicines will be cannabis flowers, and whether you extract the isolates out of those flowers or not, but the flowers, they can vary for like the amount of carbon dioxide in the air, the pH of the soil, like the temperature of the room, like that's all needs to be controlled. And that's why producers of cannabis medicines, be they UK based or abroad, they need to be able to demonstrate their ability to produce consistent batches over and over again. And they also need to be able to demonstrate that should any part of their system break down, that there are backups. Should anything happen, you're supposed to be able to provide that medication that people rely on, regardless of what happens, sort of force majeure. So yeah, it's a complex process to go through.
I can imagine the key is consistency.
Absolutely. I think, and it should be expected from a medication, that you would have good quality, consistent supply. For us, the flower that we're prescribing as part of our research program is produced by a company called Aurora, which is a Canadian company. And I've worked in cannabis medicines and clinics that prescribe them for a number of years now. And that particular producer has had very few to no issues with supply into the UK at all, which is really incredible, really.
Right. So are the plants produced kind of indoors under factory conditions or out in the fields, or how does it work?
They are produced indoors, because that is going to be the way that you control variables much more effectively. If you grow outdoors, they would be much more difficult to manage that. So I know that places in sort of Zimbabwe, South Africa, for example, they do grow outdoors, but they're not producing them to the standard that we require in the UK.
Right. Okay. Interesting. All right. So that's the clinic. Let's go on to the trial bit, because you are, you're doing a trial that all your patients are sort of in the trial. Is that correct?
Yeah. So essentially what we've sort of agreed with Research and Ethics Committee is that the process is that patients will pay to be patients at our clinic. So that's a £99 initial onboarding cost, and that covers your inhalation device being sent out to you, it covers your first consultation and the processing of the test. So we require a negative urine THC test so that we can know for sure that any benefits patients may be experiencing are from the medication that we've prescribed them. And they also...
So they're not using cannabis in any way, shape or form before the trial?
Even if they have, they need to do a washout period beforehand. Right. So we know that this particular medication, the effects it's having, so we can accurately measure that. And the other interesting thing to me is that we're doing a genetic saliva test as well. So patients will put a spit into a vial, essentially, that we'll post out to them. They post it back to us, we send it to a lab, and it gives us an overview of, it identifies particular chromosomes that show us the... like risk factors in terms of how at risk they are of developing mental health disorders if they are sort of prescribed this medication. So it's like an extra safety net that we have as part of the process. Okay. And then the medication, like each month, is £299 a month. So that is for a 24/7 nursing care access, and for the single dose of 250 milligrams of this balanced flower to be sent out by a secure courier to them. So essentially that's the experience of being a patient at the clinic. And then I will send a consent form to each of those patients to say yes, they're happy to share their data into the clinical trial, which is the most exciting part of what we do, I think, or for me anyway, as the clinician, which is that if we can start providing the evidence that NICE has asked for to start considering making it available on the NHS, we have to start with clinical trials, and that's what sure. we're trying to sort of achieve, basically. So yeah. that's right. the most exciting part for me.
Interesting. Let me just ask you a question about something you mentioned a bit earlier, this saliva test. Okay, so yeah. now you do hear stories of how some people, if they've taken cannabis recreationally or whatever, it can affect them in later life. And so the stories I've heard of people become kind of paranoid about various different things. I mean, and there are probably other things as well, but just, I suppose, two questions. How common are these sorts of side effects? And is enough known to really know what people might experience them?
No, it's a good question. I think it's something that both sort of healthcare professionals and patients sort of worry about, essentially, because it's the thing that's been sort of talked about most in the media. It's like a negative side effect, and it is a possible side effect of THC in particular, and a lot of the evidence that has been produced to give us the statistics where we say, you know, this is something that can trigger schizophrenia for people who are predisposed or have a family history. You know, that is a real risk, but that evidence has come from very high THC, very low CBD strains of cannabis, and they're often combusted or smoked, which is also not recommended as part of a prescription. If you smoke a prescription, it's void of its legality is void. The possible side effects do include that potential of sort of triggering a psychotic event if you have a family history of it, or you are prone to that experience anyway, that you would not be appropriate for a prescription of cannabis. Much like many other medications, there's the screening process sure. that people need to go through in order to be eligible for prescription, and for us that's a major one. Another major one is chronic pain patients who experience who have had major organ failure. So that's another significant one, or they've had an organ transplant in the last 2 years. Again, that's because of the potential for like tachycardia, so fast heart rate resulting from THC administration that can cause arrhythmias. If you've got cardiac history or cardiac disease, it can exacerbate that.
And I can imagine you have to be careful with all kinds of medication, though. If you've had a heart transplant, whatever medication you're taking, it's going to have to be thought about and checked out pretty seriously.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that for, you know, for me, the standard of, or the gold standard of any healthcare is to view that that person as like an individual and assess their life, their lifestyle, their symptoms, and what they're telling you is their experience as a whole. That's your job as the clinician to assess what the decision is sure. that's going to be best for that person between you. So, yeah.
All right. OK, so look, let's get on to the trial, because this is a big part of what you're doing. Now, I have to say, I don't know much about clinical trials. I think it's probably quite a large, complicated subject. But what I do suspect is it's quite easy to do them wrong. Is that kind of true? And tell us about the design of your study.
Yeah, of course. So essentially, there is like a hierarchy of different kinds of research, essentially. So the absolute gold standard is referred to as a randomized double-blind controlled trial. So that essentially means you've got a control group, you've got your active group and your control group, you've got a placebo, so no one knows exactly what it is that they're getting. That's quite difficult with cannabis, particularly inhaled cannabis, because it's a known psychoactive effect. People are expecting it. They tend to know very quickly whether or not they have a placebo or not. And that in itself skews data, because people will drop off and go, well, I know it's a placebo, I'm not going to move forward with it.
Yeah.
So what we're doing is the next best thing, which is a controlled trial. So we've got, the design is that we will have 5,000 patients who will receive what we would call standard of care for pain management. So all the things that are available for pain management currently, the opioids, benzodiazepines, like gabapentinoids, and all the sort of supportive therapies that go alongside that, then pain management programs. And then we're going to compare their quality of life scores and their NRS pain score. So the score that I know patients love when I ask them hundreds of times, if you could give your pain the score out of 1 to 10, 0 being no pain at all, 10 being as much pain as you could ever imagine. It's a very subjective thing, but it's the standard tool that we use, and we compare right. those things.
Right. Well, I suppose you can't do anything else, can you? I mean, because it is such a subjective thing.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, before this role, I worked in A&E, and what people say is a high level of pain and what they experience is a high level of pain that will differ from person to person. Some people are very reserved about them being vocal about their pain. And other people are very vocal about their pain. So it's very different.
Yeah. Actually, I do remember. So my dad, he's passed away now. But one time he broke his hip and a medic came and didn't believe that anything could have been seriously done. And my dad was saying, oh, yes, it does hurt a little bit. But he must have been in unbelievable agony, had to go to hospital, get the hip repaired. So, yeah, different for different people. I don't think I'm quite as I would have made more of a fuss, I think, is probably the simplest way of saying it.
Oh, I think the younger we are, the more vocal, as my experience is, we tend to be. My generation are going to be terrible to look after in care homes, which I've also done, because we're very uncomfortable with the idea of being uncomfortable.
Yeah. All right. So this is kind of an interesting question when it comes to the ethics of some of these tests, because you mentioned you're not using a placebo. But if you're testing a drug and you think, oh, this is the latest new drug for dealing with whatever it might be, and then so half the people get the best thing for this disease, the other half get a placebo, which is a sugar pill. You know, is that very fair?
It's the only accurate way of testing it. I think essentially if you design a trial or you have a research project that you want to undertake, you have to have it approved by Medicine Health Regulation Authority and Research and Ethics Committee. And the Research and Ethics Committee's job is to make sure that your design keeps patients safe, it's not going to cause data bias, all of those things. And you have to have it approved by them. What will happen many, many times throughout a number of years for people designing trials, so we took about 5 years to design our trial, that you present it to both of those committees and they come back with suggestions. This is what we're concerned about as part of your design. This is what needs to change. So there's a lot of sort of back and forth. And I think what people, and certainly moving from frontline practice to research, has been interesting to me is how long this process is. And that's the challenge, I think, for a lot of people.
Yeah. All right. So back to your trial, you're comparing the best pain management that exists at the moment, whatever that may be. So that could change for each patient, but it's the best that the NHS can help with.
Yeah.
Compared to your medicines. So what on your side are the different variables that you're trying out?
So things that we are measuring are the NRS pain score. So how much pain that person is experiencing or experiencing every day. And the quality of life factors. So, you know, sleep, engaging in work, engaging with family life, that kind of thing. And also we're sort of also looking at how many patients feel safe to come off of their opioid medication, which is going to be really fascinating. So that's, and often that's what patients come with to say, you know, I've been on morphine or oxycodone or tramadol for 5 to 10 years now every day, and I would like to come off of it. Is there a possibility? And this is something that we're hoping to achieve as well. So these are sort of core three things are efficacy, quality of life, and this secondary reduction of opioids.
Yeah. So those are how you measure the results. What I really meant was, what within the cannabis-based medicines are you changing? Because presumably you don't give all your patients exactly the same thing.
So we do get, so we give all the patients exactly the same medication, the same dose. And so the formulation is a balanced cannabis flower with 8% THC, 8% CBD, which sort of translates as about 80 milligrams THC, 80 milligrams CBD per gram of flower. And they're going to receive a quarter of that once a day. In an inhaled form, basically. So we're measuring. So one of the main things is that there are lots of different clinics in the country that prescribe lots of different cannabis medicines in different formulations. But what a lot of medical, to try and integrate this new group of medications into normal clinical practice, we're very used to this standard where it's like standard dose per kilogram of weight for each person, and what we're kind of, and that doesn't exist for cannabis medicines at this point. So what we're trying to do is start a seminal sort of piece of work that will start to work that out, what the standard dose might be.
Okay,
so that's, again, it's part of integrating this unusual group into standard medicine.
All right. So on your side, the cannabis-based medicines that patients are getting is all the same. It's being delivered in the same way, the same dose, etc. And then on the other side, the pain help they're getting from the NHS could actually be different for each of them. It's just kind of the best, most appropriate in the current system.
Yeah, right. And I think what we've said is that at the end of the study, the efficacy evidence will be reviewed by NICE and also NHS England. So what we're trying to sort of demonstrate is that, you know, this is what's available now. This is what could be added to your toolbox, to your care regime, and this is how much more effective or their pain management was when this was added to what you've already got. So that's kind of the core of what we're doing.
All right, no, I understand. So, and how long has the trial been going?
So we are at what's called a feasibility stage. So as part of this research and ethics committee, sort of giving feedback on your design. So what they've said is that the clinical trial is attempting to manage 5,000 patients per group. So what they've asked us to do is do a shorter 3-month study where we basically test out the design of the larger trial. So it's basically an opportunity for us to identify if there are any design flaws, essentially. So that's going to be 3 months long. We're in that recruitment phase for that at the moment. And that will be a minimum of 100 people.
Okay. All right. So you've got over 3 months before you kind of potentially get some results.
Yeah. So it would be 3 months. And then after that feasibility study, the results will have to be resubmitted. And then there will be sort of potentially a 3 to 5 month gap. And then we'll be starting with the larger clinical trials. So it's, again, it's a very long game. So when people say, you know, when will you know the answers? You're like, it could be 4 years time. It could be 1 year's time. NICE has said that a 12-month period after 1 year, they'll review the evidence if it's significant enough that we're evidently saying that 90% of the patients are getting over 50% benefit, then we may not need to continue. It may be enough data to sort of demonstrate what we were hoping to demonstrate. So it could be 1 year, it could be 3 years.
I suppose what I was trying to get at, again, in my clumsy way, is when can I invite you back on? So I was hoping it might be just over 3 months.
4 years' time.
Yeah, a while, yeah.
little while, but I promise to let you know when we can share some data with you.
Okay, but if people are listening to this and thinking, you know what, I would like to be part of the trial, you're still recruiting people for the trial?
Yeah, absolutely. So essentially we're recruiting people to be paying patients at the clinic, and then we'll be consenting them separately into the trial. So if people are either interested in finding out more information about the study or the clinic, then they can contact the clinic on the number. So the number 0333 1033 366, and one of the nursing team will pick it up. Or you can go to the website, LVLhealth. Let me just double check that one. So that is LVLhealth.co.uk, and we have a register your interest. So you can just fill in a short form and say, you know, I just want to find out more. And again, one of the nursing team will contact you.
Okay. But you can still be a patient of the clinic, whether you're on the trial or not.
Yeah, absolutely. So we're a functioning pain clinic, but this is the additional new exciting thing that we are doing.
And if you are part of the trial, do you get anything more than just knowing you're part of the trial and sort of helping mankind?
it's mostly that. This kind of there's two sort of, for me, when we talk to patients, it's two different benefits of taking part. One of them is this sort of contribution to this larger body of evidence that means more people will access it via the NHS. But also what we've said is that there is, NHS England have agreed that at the end of the study, they will review a cost comparison data set that we're going to produce that basically says this is how much it costs the NHS to look after the 5,000 people who would have been attending the NHS anyway. And this is how much it costs for those 5,000 people to receive the medication. And NHS England have said that if they can see that the effects are significantly improved and that the cost is lower than the standard of care, then they will consider paying for that patient's medication moving forward. Now, it's something they've said they'll consider, so it's not something we can promise, but it's certainly a potential benefit is that if you could join the trial, you may not have to pay for medication after that 3-year period moving forward.
Cool. All right. Look, this is really interesting. Good luck with it.
Thank you very much.
And I hope it goes well. Thank you very much indeed for chatting. And yeah, tell us when you got some results and come back on.
Absolutely. I will. Thank you.
All right, Sophie. Thank you very much indeed for chatting.
Thank you very much. Thanks, Mike.
This show is cool.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
Nagging pain. We at AlgaCells know that a small amount of the patient's own bone marrow and blood cells can treat many painful conditions with regenerative orthopedic therapy. This is an attractive treatment option for painful joints, back pain, sports injuries, and many other conditions. It may avoid the need for surgery altogether. AlgaCells, part of a network of 50 RegenX clinics worldwide, where over 60,000 patients have been treated and helped. AlgaCells. Life is more beautiful with less pain.
A cancer diagnosis can be scary and stressful for everyone involved. Hello Love is a contemporary living space and well-being center in central London where anyone can come and learn about illness prevention and non-toxic practice. Inside, you will find a vegan restaurant, juice bar, and holistic dojo that encourage lifestyle changes to help heal mind, body, and spirit connection. Cancer patients are offered free sessions. To find out more, please visit us at hellolove.org.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
Kelly Seaman from Aqualabs is an expert on hydroponics, and she's been on the show before. And in spite of that, she came back when I invited her. So I started off by thanking her very much for doing just that.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me back.
And your company is called Aqualabs, and you just told me that you make something called Shogun. So tell me, that's not a great big four-wheel drive, is it? What is it you make at Aqualabs?
So we make liquid fertilizers. Shogun Fertilizers is a hydroponic liquid fertilizer solution. We've been established now for, it'll be 10 years next year, nearly a whole decade. I can't believe how the time's just actually flown. It's just run away with itself to sort of go, 10 years we've been established.
Time flies when you're having fun. So at its heart, all this stuff is for the industry, if that's the right term, or the way of growing things of hydroponics.
That's correct. Yes, and probably a lot of people are thinking, well, what is hydroponics?
Yeah, including me, really.
Well, it's basically growing plants without soil, as the name kind of suggests. It's hydro, so it's do with water, and ponics as a for actually sort of growing, or a system as such. So it's all based around water, and it's the removal of soil. So you have to supply all of the nutrients the plant needs. And there's many different methods of doing this. You can do what's known as a deep water culture system, which uses just water, and the roots grow down into this solution of nutrients. So this solution will contain things like potassium and phosphorus and nitrogen, and the key elements that the plant needs to actually grow. And this is what we produce. We produce these liquid fertilizers that go into these hydroponic systems. But then you've got other kinds of hydroponic systems where you've got an open root network, and there's just a film of nutrient solution that is pumped over that. And that's known as a nutrient film technique. You've also then got...
So they're not completely immersed in water. They're just kind of damp, but they're not immersed in water.
Well, that is that kind of method. So, as I say, there's many different methods. You can use a media-based hydroponic system. So you can use rock wool. You know, the stuff that you insulate your roofs with, that you put into the attic, use that to grow it in, because it's completely inert. And then you would use a dripper into that kind of media. You can also use clay pebbles. You could use sand. You can use perlite. You can use vermiculite. So there's lots of many different methods. It's basically growing without soil. That is what hydroponics is.
Okay, all right. So how much of the food we eat is actually grown in this way?
Well, a lot of people don't realise that nearly 80% of the produce in supermarkets is hydroponically grown, because it's ideal for mass production. Because you're supplying the plant with everything it needs, you're going to get maximum productivity out of tomatoes, out of strawberries. You wonder why you've got strawberries in the supermarket at Christmas, and you can put that on your nice cheesecake at Christmas. And it's because they're hydroponically grown in other countries, such as Spain. But this can be a bit detrimental. Sometimes it can actually end up lacking in flavour, due to the fact that it's water that you're supplying. There's this constant supply of actually water there for them. And there's also a lack of this mycorrhizal bacteria, which convert different elements with around the root zone and actually do a lot of degrading, which can actually aid with the production of different tastes within plants as such, as tomatoes and strawberries.
Well, for sure. When I go to the market, I quite often shop with my nose. You know, I'm sure you've experienced this. I'm sure lots of people have. You go to the market, you turn a corner and you suddenly get a smell. You can't resist it. And someone's got a load of strawberries and you can smell it from, you know, a long way off. So you're drawn towards that particular stall holder and you buy some strawberries. But equally, quite often, you buy some strawberries, bring them home, and they just don't smell of anything. It seems a bit of a shame.
That can be the terpenes that are in there and the sugars. There's lots of different reasons, but the thing with hydroponics is that you're in 100% control with the plant. There isn't any degrading that needs doing to release elements so the plant can take them up. But as I say, there's a lot of going off this kind of fungal web that's occurring around the root zone. As I say, there's this bacteria, mycorrhizal fungus that work together that do help to improve flavours. There's been quite a few studies on this, and this is what the difference is with organics and hydroponics. So we don't state on anything that's it's hydroponically grown in the supermarket, but what you'll see is it says that it's organic, and it generally means that it's not been hydroponically grown.
But could you have something that's grown organically, which is an odd phrase, actually, because all the fruit is organic, but put that to one side.
Yeah.
What everyone means when they say you can have something that's grown organically, but in a hydroponic environment, could you? So you don't use pesticides and you don't use all the kind of things that protect the plants and protect the fruit. Could you call that organic and it's grown hydroponically?
Not necessarily. There are some organic fertilizers that you could use, but what you tend to find with hydroponic systems is there is a need, because you're supplying everything to it, you do need processed mineral nutrients, which doesn't come under this kind of umbrella of organics. It usually needs a soil which has not had any fertilizers applied to it. But I think it's that definition of organic. What part of the growing methodology is it that you're referring to as organic? Sure. Is, as you say, is it pest control, which comes into that? Is it what you're actually feeding to the plant, the environment itself? So there's a lot of kind of levels of that terminology, organic, and it, as you mentioned there, it's one that I don't like, because as a chemist, I just say, oh well, organic means it's got carbon in it. So everything's organic, and then it all depends which association that you're having the registration with of being organic, if they take that into consideration. But generally, additional mineral fertilizers don't come under the organic umbrella.
Yeah. Okay. All right. So let's go back to the fruit, what we actually eat. If it has been grown hydroponically, so maybe it doesn't smell quite as good as if it's grown another way. Does it have the same amount of, you know, vitamins and good stuff in for us to eat?
Yes. So the plant's still producing all of these. I think it's a lot to do as well with the actual growing technique. It's not just down to the fact that it's been grown hydroponically or organically. There's organic stuff that you actually get that doesn't have this great smell to it. Right. So there is the nutritional value. The studies which I've seen, there is no difference between the nutritional value between a hydroponically grown plant and an organically grown plant, but that's very much dependent on the growing technique, very much dependent on the kind of the processing of the plant afterwards. Well, and the genetics of the plant is also important.
Right. So, yeah, I was going to say, actually, is it also something to do with the fact that very often you've got to ship these tomatoes or what have you in, so you might pick them a bit early before you would if they were in your garden, so they don't bruise when you're shipping them, and then you hope they kind of ripen en route Is that, that might be part of the process. I know nothing about that. Do you know anything about that?
Well, there's different kind of ripening processes. So once fruit has quite often been picked, it can go under a preservation kind of method as well. So you can put it into a fridge so it doesn't rot as well as mature. But you can use a substance called ethylene in order to help the ripening of plants to encourage the colour development to occur. And sometimes that is applied to some crops in order to speed up the ripening process after post-harvest. But then there's, as I say, there's the preserving methodology to stop it actually the mold getting attached as well, which can also cause problems with flavors as well. So there's the application of those in order to stop growth of gray mold.
It's a complicated business, isn't it? There's not kind of one solution fits everything.
No, definitely not. And as you say, that I think the air miles that is on a lot of our produce that we get in supermarkets, it is a big problem, that the fact that it's not from a local farm just from down the road that was picked the day before, it's been picked a week, maybe 2 weeks previous, and then traveled to ourselves and had to go all the way through customs as well.
Well, maybe hydroponics could help solve that. I mean, could we end up with, you know, city farms, which are essentially old office blocks which no one uses anymore because they're all working at home, and convert those to high-rise farms? I mean, I just made that up, but is that kind of possible?
Yes, and it's happening. There are farms within the sort of high-rise blocks that's doing this. The thing with hydroponics is it allows for areas within the desert to be used as well. So not just city areas, you've got, you know, barren areas which are supplying all of the water and the nutrient through hydroponics to the plants so they can grow within that area. So urban gardens can be flourished by using hydroponics, but it is one of the ways that we will help to actually keep up with the current demand we have for food, such as fruit and veg.
Yeah, I'm just thinking, if you suddenly got rid of all the food that was produced or grown by hydroponics overnight, this would be pretty serious if 80% of what we buy in the supermarket is made that way.
Yes, it would. And I think the people don't quite realise how much is grown that particular way.
So if we were to, say, adapt an old office block to hydroponics and take out all the chairs and desks and fill it up with hydroponic equipment, would it be, would that take an awful lot of energy? Because presumably when things are growing, they need heat, they need light, and you've got to create that environment if it's inside.
Yep. So you can use hydroponics in greenhouses, and they do. So that's where your light would be using the natural sunlight, which is free. But if you were to convert something like an office block or to do indoor actual farming, yes, you would need to supply lights in the forms of either LEDs or high pressure sodiums, which would supply that energy so the plants can photosynthesize. That is very, very energy demanding, exceedingly energy demanding in order to keep up with that. You have to think that energy can't be created nor destroyed. It's just converted from one form to another. So if you're going to get that energy out of the plant, you need to put it in somewhere. And if you're not using the natural sunlight, you're going to have to put that in with artificial light, which at the moment with the prices of electricity, it is becoming very expensive.
And so is that happening commercially anywhere in the UK at the moment, that sort of farming?
Yes, it is. There is farms that are indoors. So quite often they will do microgreens, that methodology, in order to get maximum efficiency out of space. So you could do what's known as vertical farming. So rather than growing plants all flat on the ground, with hydroponics, what you can do is you can grow them upwards, vertically, in kind of pillars or posts or in tubes, so that you're getting the full space efficiency of where you are. And it's quite often with strawberries, they will use a tube and holes up the sides and then feed the nutrient in from the top and grow them in that way. But it's about maximum efficiency of that space. But if you're growing indoors and not using natural light, definitely going to need a lot of power.
Okay, what about something else, which actually does involve power to some extent, using fertilizer? Because I get the impression that if you use fertilizer on a regular farm, you know, out in the field, it's somewhat hit and miss. And you might use an awful lot more fertilizer than you really need because, you know, some gets wasted and spilt and all the rest of it. But with hydroponics, you can, you know, with pinpoint accuracy, use exactly what you need, which is important because fertilizer is pretty expensive.
Yeah, and this is the other advantage of hydroponics, a lot more efficient with water use. So as you say, out in the fields, if you're spreading fertilizer on and it rains, that can then be washed away into local streams. So you've got a lot more pollution with spreading fertilizer out onto the fields. Whereas hydroponics, you can produce a closed loop system, which keeps it all together. And if you're really efficient in the way that you're actually farming and in using your systems and using things to monitor the moisture of the media, so it only actually feeds when the plant requires it, and to monitor the nutrient levels, so it's only supplying exactly what the plant needs, there's a much more efficient way of actually using fertilizers to actually get out what you are wanting from the plant.
So have people figured out the time of day that plants are eating, as it were, therefore need the fertilizer?
So
is it that advanced?
No, it's not a kind of a time of day. It's more about the point in the life cycle the plant is in. So in the earlier stages, when you actually sprout a little seedling, its demand for nutrients isn't high at all. So you know that you need much less nutrients. As that then starts to grow and become bigger and go into more of a vegetative phase and aggressive growth, where it's putting on a lot of leaf mass and it's actually trying to grow so that it's producing all those solar panels that it needs, the plant demands more nitrogen around about that time. And what you can do is actually monitor the actual media the plant is growing in to find out what the plant is taking up and what is missing. So what it possibly could become deficient in, so you can correct that with your next actual nutrient feed to the plant, making it a lot more efficient.
All right. And well, I think we've heard in the news with the problems with the war of getting fertilizer, and how fertilizer is getting a lot more expensive. So, you know, this can only be making hydroponics more useful, I suppose.
Definitely. Efficient use is what we've got to become, is a lot more efficient in what we're actually doing.
All right. This is very interesting stuff. Do people do this at home, you know, sort of set up a hydroponics thing in their bedroom? It's kind of the reason I ask is because I saw an advert on it was just on the internet somehow, I can't remember exactly where, but discreet delivery of hydroponic equipment. And I thought, that's a bit odd, discreet delivery. Is that because people are a bit embarrassed that they might be cheating, and you know, the local allotment owners are going, hang on a moment, old matey boy, he's cheating? or is it because people use them to grow illegal drugs at home and they don't want people knowing what's been delivered?
Well, the principle of growing all plants is exactly the same. So I think you have to kind of make that decision yourself from that.
So, okay, all right. But I suspect this practice of growing things maybe people shouldn't be, as far as the law is concerned, might be more common than we might imagine.
Oh, definitely. Definitely. And I think the thing is, with people who choose to do that, who choose to grow their own cannabis, it's quite often because they're using it as medicine. And quite often that they will have a condition and they don't want to deal with the black market. They don't want to deal with criminals. They don't want to give criminals their money. What they want to do is produce their own medicine and make themselves self-sufficient so they don't have to deal with any of that. I worked in a hydroponic shop for nearly 10 years before I started Aqua Laboratories, and I helped many, many people who were ill and whose partner was ill, was dying from cancer. And there's many people don't want to have to go through chains that aren't necessarily right and is supporting criminal activity. But what they know is that cannabis is beneficial to them. And back when I was working in the shop, we didn't have medicinal cannabis. The law hadn't changed. It was in 2018 when cannabis could actually be prescribed on, you know, you could actually get it on prescription, you could go to a doctor and get this. So a lot of people were forced, and it was the only way that they could do that. And there were, I've met a lot of people who were, you know, absolutely law-abiding citizens, but they just chose to grow a plant in order to treat themselves. And we do desperately need a change in the law in this country.
Right. Well, so we have chatted about this topic a little bit in the past. So in fact, maybe on my blog, I'll put links to some of the shows we've had about it. It's a whole other area of discussion, really. But if people have been listening to this and thinking, all right, hydroponics sounds quite, you know, interesting, I'd like to give it a go, or just find out more about it, find out more about how 80% of the food in our supermarkets has grown, what's a potentially a good resource? I mean, has your company got a website, or are there other places?
If you check out the Shogun Fertilizers, that will tell you all about the actual fertilizer side of things. We also talk a little bit about the actual growing methodology. There's One Stop Grow Shop is another really good resource with information on there as well. But just type in hydroponics into Google. That is the best way, and that will actually start you off at Wikipedia, which is a fantastic place. Which we shouldn't reference Wikipedia, but there's a lot of good references to point you in the right direction to kind of get you started of going, this is what it's about. Okay, that's what they're talking about. But just look up myself, Dr. Callie Seaman. I talk about hydroponics quite regularly as well. So follow me on Instagram or LinkedIn, any of those kind of social media sides of things. I talk quite a lot about, as I say, different kind of growing methodologies through hydroponics.
Perfect. Callie, that's excellent. Thank you very much indeed for chatting.
No problem. Have a great weekend.
Thank you very much indeed to my guests this week. And they were Sophie Hayes from LVL and Callie Seaman from Aqualabs. And of course, a special thanks to you for listening.
That was the Relax Back UK show with me, Mike Dill. Thank you for listening. And please do join us again next time.